Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 23rd, 2005. Today's session is entitled Justice on the Road, presented by Evelyn Parker and Don Richter. Disc number PAE 2005-03.
Third session on justice. Today we're going to be exploring justice and mission, or mission trips. The prior two sessions that we had, the first one, we explored definitions of justice and shared with you the definition that has shaped the chapter on justice and way to live. And then on yesterday, we, in two different sessions, we explored or practiced strategies for addressing injustice in community. And it lifted up the value of actually thinking of Jesus' third way, an alternative way to fighting or fleeing as Jesus' third way for addressing injustice. And today we're going to see if we can look at justice and at issues of injustice as they relate to mission and mission trips, particularly since this is the season. Tis the season of many mission trips. So, having said that, I want to also remind us of the definition that we are grounding our reflections in, and that is that God wants all people to blossom and flourish. And through God's mercy, we have opportunity to be in partnership with God, to walk with God as we stand for justice so that people can live fruitful lives into God's merciful rule.
Okay. We're going to begin again this session today with a little short video. It's about 12 minutes long, I believe. It's Rick Steves. Some of you know him?
Yes.
Have you seen this video on faithful service that he's done? I think it's fairly recent. I got this actually from Tom Witt. So this is someone from your own, those of you who are Lutheran, he's out of your own communion, and he's looking at issues of travel and service travel. What we'd like you to do is think about justice issues that are raised, you know, that this video prompts for you, and after we view it, we're going to, I guess we could even go ahead and pass around, we're going to ask each of you to try to jot down about three justice issues, and it can be justice in the broad sense, related to the human community, to the environment. What justice issues are raised when we are in mission with other people through short-term mission trips, through service projects? He's looking particularly at mission and kind of international travel, which is, again, a very common form now of Christian formation for young people and for adults. So many, many groups are going out around this country and internationally. So let's view this video together and take a few notes, and we'll go from there. Okay, if we can get the lights back up. What I'd like you to do is, again, spend just a moment, if you haven't already, and jot down three justice issues that were raised for you by this short film. What are three justice issues that come to mind as you think about this? Okay, now just get for a few minutes here with one other person and kind of compare notes. Sort of share with only one other person if you can, just anybody who's nearby. Okay, let me call our attention. Some of you are still talking, sharing, but we'd like to hear a few of your comments for the whole group here as you were sharing. Maybe some of you had some similar justice issues you identified, and maybe some were different. What are a couple you'd like to offer for the group?
Lattes.
Say more.
I spent $3.50 on a latte, and I don't really think twice about it. And half the world, as Brother Rick says, lives on less than $2 a day.
Okay.
I'm going to still drink lattes because they're good, but
yeah.
Should I?
Right. One of the things that we're thinking about, I'm writing a book on this topic of making mission trips matter. And one of the things we want people to think about is, let's take a look at our food practices. Before we leave on a trip, you know, what are some things we can do to examine it? And while we're traveling, you know, while we're there with a group of people and as we come home, and see if we need to make changes. And if justice issues like this, you know, call into question certain practices. You know, fair trade coffee is a movement that certainly has gained momentum because of justice issues. Okay? What are some other things?
Priorities.
Yeah.
Priorities.
Say more.
It's a personal decision. What are your priorities as far as for yourself? I think it comes down to the individual. The individual has to act first. And you set your own priorities, whether it's where you spend your money, how you act, how you treat people. To me, it's a basic priority, and how I judge myself and what I do.
What was it in the film that kind of lifted that up for you? Just the whole thing, or did he, is there something in particular?
Well, we know Rick a little bit. And his type of travel is very, very low cost and down to the public, you know, to the people itself. And, and so we choose how we travel, and I guess I just share what Rick was saying there as far as.
Yeah, thank you. Back in the back.
Kind of along with that, the idea, like you said, a plane ticket is 2 years' wages. Thinking about how the money you spend and the way that you spend your money in travel, especially, how is your travel a stewardship, and what are you getting from that or bringing back from that you can share, rather than just laying down money for a package deal and seeing a pretty picture and bringing those snapshots home.
Right. There's an essay actually called The Cost of Short-Term Missions, which just goes directly into this and says, you know, these trips are often very expensive. And if we took the money that was spent, you know, that was raised, and the money it cost to go down there as well, the total cost of the trip, and we gave it to some of these groups we're trying to help, you know, that would be a windfall for them. Often it may be more than half their budget, you know, one group going down. So how do we even legitimate or justify spending that kind of money? You know, maybe it's just for us. Yeah. Maybe we're doing this for us more than for them. So that's kind of a justice issue that's raised. Let's see, I saw you, and then we'll go over here.
Actually, mine was the same.
The same kind of issue, okay. Yeah.
Well, mine's a similar issue, which is why I wanted to bring it up as well. But our mission trip's only for the rich, then, because travel is expensive. And not only, but like, can we use that money, you know, because we, you know, the people, I'm sure, you know, the people who are here in this room are the ones who have the socioeconomic power to be able to afford the, you know, the $1,500 round trip ticket to, you know, to Mexico or, you know, to Africa or wherever.
Yeah.
But then what about the people who, I mean, are in lower socioeconomic classes in the United States that, I mean, don't have those opportunities to be able to spend that kind of money? And what, how can we, I guess, use our financial resources for the, you know, for the greatest good, even, I mean,
yeah, okay.
You know, but also keeping in mind that there's even a privilege in just the fact that you are able to travel and are able to go see that
right.
as well.
Okay, yes.
So often when you see something like this, my first response is, it's us. What can we do about it? But we can, and we can do things in small ways, and we don't have to take the money that we would use on a plane ticket or take a huge amount to send someplace. But if we each watch what we're doing and think about, I know he's really active in Bread for the World. Rick Steves really sponsors that, and Living Waters for fresh water for people. And there are just so many ways that, in small ways, if we each contribute to these, we can make a difference. And then take some of the money that we would spend on ourselves to do that. But we don't have to do a huge thing. We can all do what we can.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
I think this is the time to tell this story. My father worked for the American government, for the State Department.
Yes.
And I grew up in Mexico, and I saw third world life.
Right.
But we spent the summer of 1960 in Bolivia when he was stationed there. And I brought down a set of pajamas for my baby that the older girl had outgrown. So by the time Kirsten was done with them, you know, there wasn't a lot of wear left in them.
Yeah.
But I said to Isabel, I've got these, I was going to leave them behind. If you can use them, and I am ashamed, and I did say I am ashamed, that they are so worn. Mm-hmm. But if you want them, you can have them. And she said to me, the poor have no choice, senora. Mm. And that has haunted me ever since. Mm. The poor have no choice. Mm.
Mm. So, in connecting to the rationale for our travel?
Well, whatever. It's something to think about when you're thinking about poverty.
And one of the things that she says in this article, Joanne Van Eyen, she says, well, in fact, you know, a lot of times the folks in these other countries will tolerate us because they have no choice. They'll oblige us. They'll provide hospitality, even though it's at some cost to them sometimes, because they hope that this may make a difference down the road. That perhaps our eyes might be open, that we might affect public policy in a way that they certainly can't.
I think that's the key when we talk about cost of travel. And I think that's what Brother Rick was getting at too, was if we're going to spend 2 years' salary to get somewhere, I don't remember exactly what it says, but we better come back with something. Mm-hmm. We better come back changed and different, because we do have the power to affect public policy. We do have the power to make changes at a bigger level than simply building a two-room house in Mexico, which is why, and I'll just stand up and say right now, I take a group every summer of young people to Mexico and build a little two-room house for a family that needs one.
Yes.
And I'm committed to that secondarily so that somebody has a structure to live in. Because we could send the money and have three houses built. Mm-hmm. But primarily I'm committed to that, at least for now, until somebody talks me out of it.
Yes.
Because of the difference that it makes for the young people from Colorado that go there.
Okay.
And so perhaps in the future, that'll grow.
Right.
But so that's where at least for me, the cost. That's the benefit that we get from the cost.
Yes. Thank you, Brother Mike.
It becomes clearer and clearer to me as we travel, and certainly the video brought these thoughts on that. We're ambassadors, whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't choose to be ambassadors. We are ambassadors.
Yeah.
And the question that comes to mind from a justice point of view is what kind of ambassadorship are we bringing to the fore when we travel?
Mm-hmm.
Is it ambassadorship of the hedonistic American, or as has been said in the past, the ugly American?
Right.
Or is it the ambassadorship of Christ? Or is it ambassadorship of compassion? Or the ambassadorship of self-sufficiency without regard to where we're going and who we're with? So to do some thinking about ambassadorship, and it occurs to me that I do worry a little bit about comparisons made related to cost.
Yes.
Only because, from our context, we're not spending 2 years' wages in terms of traveling.
Yeah.
So I mean that. That has to be acknowledged, but I think another, I mean, the aspect of ambassadorship,
yes,
has to be taken fully into account, and focusing more on why is one going, more on than what it costs to get there.
Okay. It's another related part of that is that the church is being sent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is an important understanding of mission overall, just in the same way that God sent the Son and the Son sent the Spirit, you know, the Spirit sends the church.
Mm-hmm.
From the very beginning of the church, there is a sending. And so, you know, we're sort of participating in God's sending activity. We do that whether we like it or not,
mm-hmm,
you know, as Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm,
and we can, you know, we can sort of resist maybe at different points, but we're, as you said, ambassadors. We're being sent because that's part of the mission of God in the world, that mm-hmm, sending activity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how then will we join this mission work?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit... I don't know, not deceptive is not the right word, but when we say, okay, this our congregation is sending this group in mission, as if, you know, that's some sort of extraordinary thing.
Right.
It's sort of a half-truth, maybe, because the larger truth is that we're always being sent,
yeah,
and this is just a kind of example of how that's happening. Okay, one more brief comment, and we'll switch gears.
Well, it's a little bit different. Several months ago, I heard an interview on NPR radio, and it was with a gentleman that had lived in Africa for years. Mm. And he was from England. And he gave two examples that has haunted me. One was that well-meaning people went over to this area of Africa and built cement structures to live in.
Yeah.
And those cement structures, and the people that they built them for used to live in mud huts.
Mm-hmm.
Those structures that are cement are now vacant and really bad on the mm-hmm, environment and on the impact on the land and that. And the mud huts that people built simply went back into the earth, mm-hmm, and they rebuilt a new mud hut.
Mm-hmm.
And the second example he gave was that thousands and thousands of boxes of material and clothes are sent over to this country.
Mm-hmm.
That destroyed their home textile industry.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, what do we do? I mean, you know, there are certain things that we do that maybe hurt them,
right,
and at the same time we think we're doing them a favor.
Those are powerful, both illustrations of justice issues, and even when our good intentions are there, you know, it backfires in some ways.
Right.
There's also a story, and I don't know which African country, where they have a cement structure like that that apparently gets painted every year when groups come over. In fact, the name for it in that African language is the hut that the Americans paint. And they ask him, you know, what happens in there? Well, nothing really. It's just there because it makes these folks feel good when they come over to have something to paint.
Right.
So we tell them, oh yeah, this needs painting. It gives them something to do. It makes them, helps them feel good. What, in this case, what's more important to those folks is the relationship that they're building with people, not what's being done, perhaps. Okay? We've already raised one of the issues around hospitality. Evelyn's going to say a word about that. Thank you all.
Thank you.
For your help.
I want to expand on some of your ideas, particularly as it relates to hospitality, and I'm taking some of my thoughts and even some quotes from this lovely book by Christine Pohl titled Making Room, Recovering Hospitality as a Christian Tradition. And I find what she has to say about hospitality very much very important for those of us who are considering mission or participate in mission. And specifically, as we seek to do mission with and for persons who are on the margins, like we have mentioned, and like Rick has mentioned here. She says that for persons who are in mission, we find it very difficult to be guests to those who we are, who are hosting us, whether that's hosting us in Africa, in South America, or even in the inner city of our own hometowns or our own cities or here in the U.S. We find it difficult to do that. And let me just share this little story. She talks about in this chapter on hospitality and power. She mentions a church that she observed, and she says, "I witnessed a powerful expression of this phenomenon when I regularly attended a mission church. Although there was potential for some leadership from within the congregation, the resources almost always came from outside. One holiday season in particular, I watched with deepening dismay as waves of well-meaning suburban congregations came to the mission to help. They provided dinners, brought gifts, and led the worship programs. There was, in fact, nothing that the local congregation needed to do. Everyone assumed that the local people had nothing to offer. They became guests in their own church building. And despite the festive trimmings, disempowerment would be a generous description of what had happened." I think back to some of my own experiences, particularly traveling in developing countries, and the difficulty I had as being a guest in those places. After messing up a couple of times and having that opportunity to go to be with people in Africa, I realized that I was a terrible guest. I didn't receive the hospitality that was extended to me. And people on the margins take receiving the stranger very, very serious, because it's a life and death situation for most of them. My own experience was that it took me some time. It was a journey to really realize that these people spent a large amount of their income to get fresh water for me, because they knew that I could not tolerate their water. So they made sure that there was water for me to drink, that there was water for me to brush my teeth. Some of their children gave up their rooms so that I would sleep in them. They prepared before my coming for weeks and weeks and weeks to make sure everything was clean, that there was food that I could tolerate. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of work and time and care that went into being a host. And then I would have the audacity to be snub at some of the things and say, "Oh, I can't drink that, or I can't tolerate that." I'm not saying don't use your head, don't think sensibly. But what I had to learn was that I needed to trust my host to extend hospitality to me, realizing they knew what I needed and what I could tolerate, sometimes even better than I did. So my point, and I think what Christine Pohl helps us with, is that in doing mission, we have to be very intentional on being the guest. We go to Africa, we go to South America, wherever we go on our mission trips, we go with this intent and a very genuine intent to help those in which where we're going. But I think what she offers to us is a way to think about how we receive from our hosts the blessings that are in store for us, even those that we have not even imagined. One other quote that I want to offer here from her book is that there's a complex dance between recognizing our own need, ministering to those in need, and recognizing their ministry to us. The helper must also be able to receive, especially from those who look as if they have little to offer. I invite some of your experiences and your responses to some of the things that I've just kind of quick and dirty summarized from Christine Pohl, some of your responses in terms of the dynamics between the host and the guest, especially in the midst of mission trips that we do. Yes.
I had the opportunity to study abroad in Tanzania and East Africa for a semester. And it was to be a study service trip. I was going to be teaching English in a Swahili classroom, as well as studying at the university. And I definitely encountered that, I definitely was humbled by my classroom of students going in thinking, how am I
going to reach them when we both have very little of the other's language? And how am I going to teach them what they need to know from me? We ended up doing a lot of cultural lessons to kind of try and bridge the gap. And because I had a camera and my 52 students in the one classroom hadn't had pictures of them taken, I decided I would teach them about picture day and give them all a photo of themselves. And they were really excited about that. But after I had given them these simple pictures, they overwhelmed me with gifts. They brought me flowers, they brought me congas, and they had a dress made just for me. The whole class took a collection and had a dress made just for me and a matching head wrap. And it took all of those things to move me from being so frustrated about how I was going to accomplish my mission to realizing that their mission for me was a lot more important for my time there. So.
Others?
Yes. Our son and his wife were 2-year Peace Corps volunteers in Ecuador. They were serving in Macas, which is on the edge of the jungle, where the people have lost their animals to hunt, but they've never been agrarian, and they're just suffering on that edge. So they had made acquaintance with people living in that edge world, and so they said, we want to go visit these people. They'd love to meet you. And so we trekked in about 3 miles walking to meet them. And our son says, well, we need to take 2 chickens along because they will have nothing but yuca to feed us, and they would receive the chickens well. So we brought 2 live chickens, and we visited, and the chickens were being roasted over a fire and later brought on banana leaves. We were watching the man weaving baskets for us with the very weaving techniques, and we watched all. And then they presented all of these gifts to us. Mm-hmm. But the one was wondrous, because I think we did it right. Because our son and his wife knew how to go in, and we kind of loved each other for that day. And we were impressed that as we finished eating our chicken off of the banana leaf, the kids came around and took all the bones and just gnawed the bones, almost nothing left. Mm-hmm. They ate the bones. Mm-hmm. You know, the poor have no choice, because they have so little. Mm-hmm. They ate the bones.
Well, it's clear that there are blessings even in being a guest. It's a journey. We come from privileges. We come from abundance. Even if we would go into inner city Seattle, there's lots to learn as the guest in that community, and not so much to go and take everything, assuming that we know what they need, but to be in partnership with the communities in which we go to serve in our missions, as they too will serve as our hosts, and we can be good guests in their midst. So, thank you. I want to just take now time to shift back to Don, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of our expectations or some of the things we carry into missions.
Yeah, I'm just very moved by both of these stories of, you know, the generosity that was there, that maybe, you know, we don't anticipate. We're conscious about what we're bringing, because, you know, when we pack, we've got our backpacks or our duffel bags, whatever we're taking, and we're putting all our stuff into that, and we're very conscious about the things that we're carrying with us. We also carry metaphorical baggage as well, right? We carry, as we've talked about, we're U.S. citizens. Think about we're the bearers of empire, right? When we're going on trips, whether we like it or not, we represent what the U.S. is as we go out different places, and so that's part of what we're carrying with us. A place where these themes kind of come together. How many of you have read Barbara Kingsolver's Poisonwood Bible? Several of you. You remember how she portrays the guy there, Nathan Price, and that's an interesting choice of name. You know your Hebrew, Natan, means gift, right? My son's name here is Jonathan, which would mean Joe, Nathan, you know, gift of God. Natan means gift, and so Nathan, price, is a gift that comes with a price tag attached. And that's the way this guy is. He goes into the Congo in the late 50s. He's a self-appointed Baptist missionary, takes his wife and four daughters, drags them into the Congo against the advice of his church, and proceeds to, you know, try to bring his American imperial ways, demonstrated, for instance, by planting the Kentucky Wonder Bean in rows, if you recall. And they try to help him. They go out in the middle of the night and they build them back up into mounds. So, but he comes and he says, look, these people don't know anything about agriculture. He puts them back in rows, and then the first rains come and wash them away. And then, moreover, there's no pollinators there. Once the plants grow, they don't have enough pollinators to help them. So even in his agricultural practice, he sort of has this imperialism. He doesn't know how to receive the gifts and the generosity of the very people he's there to serve. Whereas his predecessor, a guy named Brother Fowles, comes and they have some wonderful conversation. His Brother Fowles talks to him about, you know, can't you see how receptive these folks are to the gospel and to the imagery of the gospel? They in some ways get it so much better than we do. And Nathan Price has a hard time seeing that. But this other fellow who is, one of the daughters thinks he looks like Santa Claus. He comes as a St. Nicholas figure, whereas Nathan comes with a price tag attached. Anyway, if you haven't read that book, I think that's a fabulous book to read or to go back to, where it talks about, again, what we're carrying with us and what kind of justice issues are involved as we presume to be, you know, bearers of the gospel, and as we come with our American passports when we go, because we can't, I mean, that's who we are. So we have to go out in that way. And yet we are part of the church that's being sent, and so that's part of what we have to do. Yes?
Unfortunately, sometimes we're also perceived not only as being bearers of the gospel, but being bearers of our culture, right, which is thought of as one of the same.
Yes.
Sometimes. And on occasion, I found one of the difficulties is the feeling of one wants to, so to speak, stand alongside of,
yes,
or recognize this, while the person that I'm visiting or in relationship with or living near, what is more interested in becoming the culture they perceive I have. Or maybe another simple illustration would be, I taught in Namibia.
Yes.
And because the nearest place to really buy anything was 60 kilometers,
right,
there was a small car provided for our use when we needed to go to get things. There was also a village a few miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my own lifestyle value,
right,
is if I'm able to bicycle or walk or something, I'm not going to use the car.
Yeah.
But to them it was inconceivable and made absolutely no sense that I would walk to that village without taking the car, because they were just living for the day when they'd be able to have a car.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gets really, really complicated sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It does. That's an important insight too, because Christian faith always wears clothing, cultural clothing. And it has to wear some clothing, you know. And in our case, we're North Americans, and we bring the culture that we have. So the gospel always has to be embodied in a particular culture. It can't sort of hover above it. And so that is confusing at times for people, because they are attracted perhaps to things that are American culture offers. But part of the challenge for people in mission has been right along to find ways to communicate the gospel in ways that, through the culture that's local, that's indigenous. And there's been cultural imperialism, but there's also always been that impulse, because that's the impulse of the gospel. it is to assume the cultural forms and language of that are native places. We don't have the same, we don't have a holy one holy language or one holy place. Every place can become the bearer of the holy. Every language can become the bearer of God's word.
But I can give you another example in Papua New Guinea. I was teaching students who were, their parents were in an area where they still used stone axes. There was, I mean, they had, were beginning to have access to many other things.
Right.
But to just show you a level. But again, where it's so mixed up with the culture one brings,
yes,
that they heard of an Australian teacher who had given his students all American names. And so they came, and they thought it was awful that I didn't want to give them American names instead of their own wonderful names. And so they have, you know, such a struggle too to
it's a tension. It will be always a tension because people will be certainly drawn to the culture that's exotic and different, and how we can help, you know, work with that and enable appreciation of the local culture is a justice issue. As Rick Steves mentioned, you know, lots of languages are perishing, lots of local customs and ways are perishing, and so we need to help, as we're engaged in mission with people, help to lift up what's there. We don't only go overseas for mission. We have a lot of mission activity in this country across cultural boundaries. One woman last week told me that the most challenging mission trip she took with her youth group was to a neighboring town where the parents, where there was a lot of resistance because they knew the location, and they said, well, we don't want our kids going in that place. It's dangerous. You know, we don't want our kids going, working in that area. They would have thought nothing of them going down to Mexico or somewhere else, but, you know, right next door, this was a whole different can of worms here for them. So what happens, though, is that now when people are going to these different places, they often rely on agency to help, especially if it's a group of youth and adults that are going. The youth programs, there are lots of agencies that set up these trips for young people. And in the few minutes remaining here, what's some advice you would give? If you were the board of a church, you're serving on your church board, and a group comes to you and says, we've got an agency that's going to help us with this mission trip, and they're going to, you know, plan all the things out. They'll do Bible studies, and they'll help us process this. What are some of the, given the justice issues we've been talking about, what are some of the criteria you would say need to be there? Some guidelines for partnering with this agency?
Okay. It's definitely a financial one, because you want to know what percentage of the money that you're giving to this agency is going to the agency, and which percentage is actually going to the trip.
Okay.
So you want to make sure that the money is going, the priority is set on the person,
yes,
and where you're going, rather than to this agency.
Yes.
Good.
Okay.
Any others related to that?
Not directly related. I would want an invitation from the people I would be visiting, and prior to going, establish a communication and relationship.
Invitation.
By their invitation.
Invitation from the people you're going to,
yes,
and establish some type of dialogue prior to going,
yes,
there. And if you're taking some young people, perhaps a beginning of letter writing, if that's a possibility.
Yeah.
I'd like to know how long this agency has been doing this and how successful they have been by talking with some of the other groups that have use this agency.
So some upfront research,
yes,
about the agency itself,
mm-hmm,
and its history, perhaps how much they have given back to the community,
right,
which they facilitate a trip on.
Along those lines, just researching how interested that agency was in actually creating partnerships or creating relationships between the two groups, and again, what amount of the cost is coming to them.
Do you see a hand in the back?
Yes.
Maybe looking at the long-term relationships after this trip is ended, is that it, or right. Is there something long-term?
Or is it possible that the church or the community can be sister churches, sister partners, or whatever you want to, however you name it, as a group, however you negotiate it together, that there's some equal sharing in what that relationship, that partnership will be?
I want to know the history of the, I guess the place or wherever the assistance would be going. I want to know if they've been held before. What kind of history they have in terms of receiving assistance from any other entity.
Okay. The actual mission site, and if they've had experience, the history of receiving sure. services from others.
Have they received it at all? And if they have, why did it stop? And why are we starting it again?
I heard someone mention earlier in our conversation today about addressing systemic issues that cause people to be in poverty. Any thoughts on that in terms of the relationship, selecting not only a site, but an agency?
Can you give a for instance?
Well, I'm wondering about issues around fair trade. I don't know exactly what it was, but even policies that we might implement here within this context that would have a long-term positive effect on the people in which we've gone to in terms of the mission. I don't know if the agency has any relationship to that, but we could explore those possibilities.
Even things like, you know, how green they are. Yeah. I mean, a lot of these groups that do this, I've been told, are just, they use, you know, tons of disposable stuff, because they'll have maybe 400 kids come and every week, and they'll do this all summer long. And this is their business. And, you know, every week, another 400 kids, and everything is disposable. So mounds and mounds of trash created for this. And some of these agencies have no history with the community really before, and there's no follow-up. If you ask them, well, what about an ongoing relationship, they just sort of look at you like, why would you want to do that?
Yeah.
So.
Any others?
You talked about this before, but maybe how the agency helps to facilitate an empowerment of the community you're going to serve, mm-hmm. and how it facilitates those doing the mission as being guests, okay. to what it teaches you about the place before you go. Mm-hmm.
Good.
I guess going along with that is it's the idea of giving a fish versus teaching the fish.
And as I think about Rick Steves, and his connection with, is it Bread for the World?
Bread for the World, yes.
I would be interested in an agency and their relationship to organizations like Bread for the World, or WCC, ecumenical groups that have concern about various places around the world as we do mission. Good. This is really good.
Thank you all very much. You've helped me with my book a bit here, so I appreciate your time and your contributions to the sessions on justice and on this one in particular today. And again, a key issue is, I think, this partnership. Yeah. I think that all of us, the experiences we've shared and what I hope will happen as we move into the future is that we'll find ways to have ongoing relationship with groups in mission, and not just sort of hit or miss, you know, in and out type of experiences that we've done before.
So, I'd like to take a minute. This is, I suppose you could call it a commercial.
Okay, commercial break.
You know, Holden, you've been hearing about Holden Village and Abriendo Caminos. And that was Diane Shiner's idea. I think this is going to be the third or fourth year they've done it. A lot of the people who are targeted are the orchard workers in the Wenatchee Valley. Mm-hmm. And they don't have very much. And Holden recognizes this. So they've built in scholarships into their budget to help them pay their way. Mm. And my sister said to me, if you give me $50 so that it would help them pay the boat ticket, there are people who can come if they can get the boat ticket. Think about it and go up to the registration and say, I'd like to donate, or talk to Karen Strum. I know that Faith in Lutheran in Leavenworth would take money for boat tickets. I'm sure that the churches in Wenatchee and Chelanwood, or maybe Holden, will see that the funds are available. Pass the word around.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much.